The Hebrew Order of David is one of our community's oldest and most established global outreach organizations. Join Stan Clare for the next hour as he explores the issues facing the men in the community. The HOD Hour is a fundraising initiative for the HOD. Welcome to the HOD Hour with Stan Clare.
And I'm Stan Clare, and welcome and good evening. And tonight, everyone is present, and everyone is present. Our guest, Terry Kurgan, the author of the book, Everyone is Present, and my producer, Natalie Solomon, who's prepared 1,000 questions, so I don't know how you're going to cope, Terry, and also DJ Flo at the controls, and welcome to the HOD Hour. Terry, I just want to start off by painting you a picture of the Hebrew Order of David. So the Hebrew Order of David is a fraternity. So why did we invite a lady who wrote a book about her maternal grandfather? So how does it all fit in? And why did you track your maternal grandfather and not your paternal grandfather? This is, after all, a patriarchal society. And so there must have been a reason. Was it easy to get the material, or was it something special, or was there a special bond, or what was behind it?
Well, my maternal grandfather left behind, when he died, the most extraordinary personal archive. He kept diaries, handwritten diaries, every single day of his life. And he must have been keeping them long before the first section of the diary that we have. But we have diaries from the first day of the Second World War, 1st of September 1939, as he flees the city that they were living in Poland. And these diaries had been in a drawer in his own writing desk with my mother after he died. She took care of the diaries, the photographs, all his personal papers, and they'd never been translated. And he died in 1973, and I was fascinated with them as a young child. I would collate them, organize them, see where there were gaps, find the occasional word in English. But he kept diaries in Polish and German every single day of his life.
Did you speak Polish? How did I know you speak about the complexity of translation, but yourself?
No. So I'm an artist and a writer and a sort of part-time academic. And when my mother, 5 or 6 years ago, agreed to hand me guardianship of the diaries, I raised a grant. And through Wits University, I slowly began to have these diaries translated in order to begin writing the book that you have in your hands.
So this is 80 years ago, 1939. It's now 2019. It took a long time for these diaries to see the light of day and for you to put it into a book, and it all started with a photograph.
It all started with a photograph. I'm principally an artist, more recently a writer. And in fact, you know, I'm an artist who works in many different media, and writing seemed the right medium for this job. The photographs are photographs that were shot between the photographs that are threaded through all the essays, all the chapters in this book, are photographs shot by my grandfather between 1935 and 1945, and they've always had an extraordinary sort of, I've used them in bodies of work over the years since I was a teenager, you know. I think trying to tease the secrets and the meaning out of them. But the whole book begins with a photograph that hung over me my whole childhood. It was a photograph, I thought, of my grandmother and my grandfather and my little mother, my 4-year-old mother, whispering into the ear of the man who has his head turned away from the camera. But it turns out that was my grandmother's lover at the time, and then my grandfather shot the photograph. And so the book begins with that.
It's quite an open society in those days.
It was. It was. Marriage was
complicated.
Sort of, yeah, yeah.
I think you speak a lot to different levels of betrayal, and that picture speaks so much around that and the complexity of betrayal. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Well, I use that photograph the photograph performs, you know, many roles in the first essay in the book. So the photograph is taken in the Tatra Mountains in Zakopane, which was a most extraordinary mountain resort that between the, in the interwar period, was a place that writers, poets, even Lenin visited frequently. It was a place where people experimented with drugs, they experimented with sex, they experimented. It was a very avant-garde bohemian community who lived there. And my grandparents would set off for Zakopane and for the same resort every summer and every winter. And so I use it to really tell the story of Zakopane, but also of Poland in the interwar period on the one hand.
The Zakopane is in Poland?
Yes. It's still in southern Poland. It's in the Tatra Mountains, right near, it's in fact quite close to Krakow.
Right. And the town where your grandparents came from?
They came from, originally they were born in Lvov and Brode. My grandfather came from Brode, my grandmother from Lvov. Which cities are both in Ukraine now. But my grandfather, when he married my grandmother, part of what my grandmother brought into the marriage were beer factories. And one of them was just outside Bielsko. Bielsko is 30 kilometers from Auschwitz, in fact, which is where they would have ended up had they not left.
So before the war, there were something like 5,000 Jews in that town?
Yeah.
I believe there's only about a dozen.
But my grandfather was working in a beer factory. But getting back to the photograph, I use the photograph to tell the story of Zakopane, the story of Jewish life in the interwar period, but also a very personal story about a sort of dysfunctional marriage and the beginning of betrayal that is repeated all the way through the book. The photograph, you know, the book is very much about intergenerational transmission, you know, things that are passed down in DNA, you know. There's a psychoanalyst, Nicholas Abram, who said, "What haunts are not the dead, but the gaps left within us by the secrets of others." And you know, I've subliminally inherited and tried to make sense, close these gaps, by doing a lot of exploration, both research and forensic examination of these family photographs.
So you've actually written, this is a book, we're talking to Terry Kurgan. She's written a book, Everyone is Present, which is both contains a lot of photographs and also contains a lot of wording which you've written yourself. And it's interesting that you were interviewed by a professor, Andrew van der Vlies, who's a extraordinary professor. I don't know what extraordinary means. Extraordinary professor at University of Cape Town, and he's a professor at the Department of English at Queen Mary University. But he wrote about you. Terry Kurgan is one of South Africa's most accomplished and sophisticated theorists of her own photographic practice. Now, does that actually mean that you're self-examining everything? Are you deeply introspective? Is it, do you question yourself all the time?
No, I don't think he means that, but I think he means that.
I found it a strange sentence, actually. It took me hours to really comprehend what he's saying. And this is an English professor.
Yeah. No, I think he's referring to, you know, as an artist, I've put together bodies of work that often use found photographs, archival photographs, and then I'm called upon to write essays about the work. And I've written a lot. I've never written narrative nonfiction. I've never written a book like this, which is a detective story. It reads like a novel, actually. You know, that's what narrative nonfiction is. I mean, it has a plot. Each individual essay has a plot and the book has a plot. But I also write a lot in a more academic way. So I think that's what he's referring to. I write a lot about photography, about photographic meaning. I write a lot about vernacular, you know, everyday domestic photography, family photography.
Right. So you in the book, you really talk about the reluctance of your grandfather was a reluctant immigrant to South Africa.
Yes.
And I don't know about your grandmother, Maybe she didn't want to leave her lover behind, and she came along for the ride, seeing what another side of the world looked like. But why the reluctance, and why did he stay?
Well, they were never aimed for South Africa, as you probably know. Between 1937 and 1948, Jews weren't allowed into this country. Prior to that, there was the Quota Act.
Yes.
But they took a very unusual route out of Europe, and they got out just as the border between Poland and Romania closed. I mean, the Germans were bombing. The sentry guards left the border post, and my family pushed through on foot. They went from Romania via the Persian Gulf. They went in exactly the opposite direction that refugees are going today. They lived in Aleppo. They lived in Baghdad. They went to live in Bombay. And all the time they were trying to find a country that would take them in. And they were actually aimed for Brazil, not South Africa. And the South Africans weren't going to let them disembark the ship here. They were allowed to briefly be in transit and pick up a ship from – they were going Bombay to Cape Town, Cape Town to Rio. And what happened was my uncle, they were an extended family group of 10, got smallpox. And so the whole family were quarantined in Mombasa in a hospital for infectious diseases. In fact, their permission to enter South Africa are these, you know, almost like a passbook that was issued to them. And last known address, you know, these were Jews. Nobody wanted them. They were... You know, they had to flee for their lives, and their last known address was Hospital for Infectious Diseases, Mombasa. I found that very ironic and bitter.
Amazing history in Germany, Poland, I guess, as well, is that it was probably easier to leave there than it was to get into another country.
Yes.
So whilst you could leave, probably you couldn't get in where you wanted to go, or even wherever anybody would take you. So this actually is a documentary proof of of the situation, which I suppose a lot of people would like to deny. But
my grandfather, you asked why he loved Poland. You know, he really identified as a Pole. And he was a Jew, but he was a Pole. And he was very reluctant to leave home. He loved the culture. He was university educated, introspective intellectual. He'd been to university in Berlin and Vienna. You know, these were not religious or shtetl Jews. They were...
So percentage-wise, the Polish Jews were in the minority coming to South Africa. Mm-hmm. I mean, the vast majority of Jews who came here came from Lithuania.
And I mean, that is
one of our... we're very proud of that fact, but we don't mind a few polls now and again in between.
But I think that the book speaks to such an important part of that desperation not to leave and the hope that somehow it will be okay. And I think you write such a beautiful part around how he wonders if his plants will still be watered. And the detail and almost the disbelief of what's really going on.
I know, and it's extraordinary when in 2013, which is when I first started reading the translations of these diaries, with the knowledge that I have of what happened, read him in 1941 wondering about he's on a ship and it's a British ship and they're sailing from Basra to Baghdad. And there's a ball on the ship at the same time as they've got a blackout curtain and one single blue light bulb. The British passengers who are on their way to Bombay, in fact, have got full evening gear, and my grandfather's wondering whether he'll get back to his cupboard in Bielsko to pick up his tuxedo. Mm. And as you've mentioned, worried about whether the neighbor with whom he'd left the keys would continue to water the plants until he got back.
Mm. So you went back to where he lived?
No. But he's imagining in 1941.
No, I'm saying you.
I did. I went back to, there's a chapter in the book where I returned to the building. And there are only 9 apartments in the building. And the building looks like it hadn't been swept since 1939. And we try, my mother and I, go back with my mother, who left there 75 years ago, and has very vivid recollection.
Was with your grandmother?
My mother.
Your mother?
My mother, you who went, is still alive.
Yes.
I went back with my mother, who was 4 years old when they fled. And she has very vivid recollection of certain, she has vivid, sort of visceral recollection of certain things about her early childhood. Perhaps because it was so abruptly terminated, you know, they fled. But we went back to the building and we could, well, I don't want to,
don't spoil it for the reader, yeah. Otherwise we'll have no more sales. And by the way, the book is sold out.
No, it's not.
We already,
but very important to note that it's actually been nominated for the 2019 Sunday Times Alan Payton Literary Award shortlist. So it's a really prestigious award, well, a prestigious nomination.
Thank you.
So the Hebrew Order of David is proud to say that we are offering the person who sends in the correct answer to the question we're about to pose. And if you send a telegram to 061-895-1019 or SMS the number 34519 and you tell us who is the publisher of the book Everyone is Present, written by Terry Kurgan, sitting with me in the studio, and we're talking to Natalie and grilling Terry about everything that's going on and about the book. So if you would like a copy, and the first person to send in the correct answer, who is the publisher of the book Everyone is Present, written by Terry Kurgan. So Terry, what did your grandfather do when he got to South Africa? I presume he worked. He didn't have a pension coming from Germany, that's for sure.
No, he really struggled. I mean, he was in any event living the wrong life, which I write about, you know, even if the war, the Holocaust, all of that hadn't happened, he was the, as I said, he was a sort of intellectual. He was a melancholy, introspective intellectual, and he really wanted to study medicine. But at the time, Jews weren't allowed into medical school. And so what was available to him was he had a PhD in philosophy, but he became a manufacturing pharmacist. And his family had, he came from a quite important family in Brode. They were mayors for generations, mayors of the city of Brode.
So the two cities actually combined, because it's known as Bielska Brode.
No. Brode is in the east of Poland, where he was born and grew up. He moved to Bielsko, which is southwest.
So what's the connection between the two?
Is that this is where he grew up and went to school. His family, the Kalia family, yeah, descend from rabbis and rabbinical poets and so on. And
we're talking about Jacek.
Right, Jacek Kalia. And Brode was the seat of the Haskalah, of the Jewish Enlightenment. He really grew up in a most extraordinary atmosphere of enlightenment and learning. And he was an intellectual, and when he came to South Africa, he really struggled to make a living. He had a laboratory in Salt River, and he experimented with all kinds of supplements and alternative medicine. What he was doing then is now a multi-zulti billion-dollar industry internationally.
Yes.
I was brought up on ground donkey bones. For calcium, I had to, every single morning, teaspoons of these ground bones mixed with orange juice. It was ghastly. But, yeah, he was ahead of his time.
Sounds like my grandchildren would enjoy that.
I mean, the beauty of your book is how you examine the personal against the backdrop of the political. And it really gives us an insight into the lived experience. Something that you spoke about is what they packed on board. Can you tell us a little bit about what the lived experience looked like, just in terms of some of the details?
That's a lovely question, Natalie. I'm, you know, the sort of person who's obsessed with objects that have their roots in the past. That's why I always coveted those diaries. I was dying to be able to have them translated. I was so curious about them. And he does, you know, they leave in sort of 5 minutes. You know, the Germans are bombing and they know, wow, this is really bad for the Jews. And they pack, each pack a rucksack, and they take very little with them. And my grandfather describes taking his revolver. He was a stamp collector, a very serious stamp collector. He takes his stamp collection, the photographs, his revolver, and a change of clothing. And that's
what... did you remember to take your mother, your grandmother?
She went ahead of him.
Otherwise, he probably would have forgotten in the rush.
Yeah.
And then life on board the ship in terms of passing time and I guess the enormity of running for one's survival and the mundanity of everyday life. Can you talk to that a bit?
Well, the where he most, you know, my grandfather becomes a writer. In the, they spend periods on ships where, you know, it's almost like when you get in an aeroplane, you know, the anxieties of your life fall away, you're in limbo. And the 2 weeks, the intervals of time that they spent on a ship were his happiest, and he becomes very poetic. He writes exquisitely about, you know, the Persian Gulf as they pass through it. He writes about mountains. He writes about the color of water. He's seeing black people for the first time. He describes Indians. He describes, and there's an extraordinary sense of peace that comes over him where he's not having to negotiate every single day, stand in line outside embassies, struggle to get visas, be rejected. They're penniless. They're constantly, pawning and selling jewelry. They were upper middle class wealthy Jews. They took their literally, you know, as people did, sewed their jewelry into the lining of their coats.
Yes.
And their jewelry bought their passage all the way to South Africa, at which point the Jewish Board of Deputies in Cape Town and the Jewish orphanage took them in. And that was in 1942.
So there's a big, push at the moment for people to revisit where their parents and their grandparents came from, and to investigate their roots, go back the March of the Living, going back to the place like you did to Poland to find out. There's a book written by a lady in America called My Grandfather's House. She went back and found just a concrete slab. So when you went back there, were you shocked by what you found? Did you find, was it more or less what they had what your grandfather had described? You don't mention your grandmother, by the way, a lot in this. I'm presuming that she was part of the equation and
had something to say. I do write about her a lot. I do write about her a lot, but I suppose we've been discussing, you know, the translations. Yeah.
More talk about men in this program.
The Hebrew Order of David.
It is, after all, a fraternity.
It was extraordinary going back to Bielsko, which was, there were only 5,000 Jews in Bielsko. It wasn't a big Jewish community. It wasn't a big town. And it's one of the many towns in Poland that is called Little Vienna. You know, it really, it import, you know, turn of the 20th century. I mean, all the architecture and cultural life were imported or copied from Vienna. It's an exquisite town, and it's because it was a point of entry for the Germans. It wasn't destroyed. It remained perfectly intact. There was an odd little synagogue and an odd little Jewish museum run by a couple of women who weren't Jewish, and they had, for example, the 1939 phone book in which I found my grandfather and grandmother's, it confirmed the address that we had only ever seen in an identity book that remained. Okay. It confirmed that this indeed was their address. This was their phone number. There's very little trace of Jewish life and of anything that came before.
But there's a long list of Jews, important Jews who went to other parts of the world. And amongst them, you talked about architecture, quite a number of architects, doctors, educated people. So clearly it was a place where they took pride in their education. I mean, that is a Jewish thing. But the fact of the matter is that it looks like a town that, you know, people living around the world continued doing what they were doing and found work in the same sort of context of what they used to and what they saw.
Yeah.
Of course, everybody was up. There was a big upheaval.
Yeah.
So where did people, you know, find themselves, and some fared better than others.
Yeah.
So it's sad in a way that your grandfather struggled with the fact that he had to leave, and I can understand that. I mean, leave your home behind and come here.
It was a common experience. Mm. And in fact, what I find so interesting is your mom's response to being back in Poland, that she becomes enlivened in terms of the irony of home where one was really persecuted and yet home still feels like home.
She was, you know, as I say, she left when she was 4 and a half, and on her 80th birthday, my mom has been living in Los Angeles the last 40 years, and I went to Los Angeles for her 80th birthday, and the two of us then went on this return trip. We started off in Warsaw, where we finally retrieved a copy of her original birth certificate, which she'd never, you know, they left without that kind of document. I located the archive where these documents were stored. And then we went on this trip together, and there was something about, you know, she grew up with food, speaking Polish language, in Cape Town. I mean, her parents came in a group. There were 10 family members, including 3 young children. And so Polish was her first language, and it was spoken until her parents died with her parents. And, there was something about the familiarity of the food, the music, I was struck by her happiness in this place that had so cast them all out, you know.
A lot of Jews didn't know they were Jewish in Poland, and their parents actually denied their Jewishness, and they only found out sometimes when the mothers were on the deathbed and people, you know, so obviously the persecution, I suppose those that remained didn't want to be known as Jewish. And so, I mean, they were lucky to get out, but they seem to have clung on to...
No, they were secular university educated, but they did. From my grandfather's diaries, I can see, like, the main chagim, the main festivals, like for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. He always went to the synagogue.
Are these diaries from his life before he left, or was it only during the... while he was traveling?
We only have them from the first day of leaving.
Did he write a diary before that, or he done
that? He must have. I mean, I can't imagine that he just started. It doesn't make sense. You know, this must have been a private space that he, you know, that comforted him his whole life. He was, as I think I was saying earlier, he had a very domineering father, so he wasn't allowed to study what he wanted to study because he was a Jew. He also couldn't. His father insisted, he was the only son, that he come into the family pharmaceutical business. He was quite weak in relation to my grandmother. They were very ill-matched, obviously, but he was, and then he was sort of stranded in South Africa.
Did they remain married all the years?
Yes, all the years. Together? Yeah, great.
On those days,
incredible.
They didn't give it up that easily today. You know, at the top of a hat, people get divorced, but it wasn't so much.
No, he was often
happy. Did
she
ever go back to her lover? No?
Can
I ask that question?
No, not to that lover, but to other lovers. And he was often very happy for her sort of success in attracting other men. But he loved her, he adored her, and he was, it really distressed him, you know, that.
Yeah, I think
she didn't return.
You speak about the complexity of her personality and how the struggle for your dad to keep her attention was also introduced through the struggle of your mom to keep her affection and attention, and how hard it was to be mothered by your grandmother. Can you talk a little bit about your mom's experiences of her mother and its complexity?
My grandmother was quite distracted. I mean, there were so many layers there was so much difficulty. I mean, the trauma of abruptly being separated from everything that has come before, you know, on both sides of the family. So my grandmother's family and my grandfather's family had lived in the cities in the east of Poland for generations. They'd endured both world wars. Well, they were in the throes of the Second World War. But my grandmother's mother, So my great-grandmother was an incredibly sort of narcissistic. You could say she had a narcissistic personality disorder. She was an incredibly narcissistic, poor mother herself who didn't teach her son or her daughter any nurturing skills. She was incredibly self-centered. And my grandmother was like that too, very self-centered. And, you know, between my mother grew up, not being paid significant attention. I think those early years were so traumatic because of the fleeing, the journey they had to take, the insecurity, the danger. They were always in danger. She had a very disrupted and, deprived childhood in many ways.
Must have been horrific. Mm. So we're talking to Terry Kurgan. She's the author of Everyone is Present. It's a book about her grandfather on her maternal side. This being the fraternity. We talk about, fraternity and the male domination. But, we're giving away the book. And if you send in the name of the publisher,
the independent South African publisher.
The independent publisher. We'll give the name at the end of the show, but you need to send it in before to 061-895-1019. That's a telegram to SMS. You can SMS to the number 34519. We want the name of the independent South African publisher of the book, Everyone is Present, written by Terry Kurgan. And we'll send you the book free of charge wherever you are in South Africa and by Overnight Express. So Natalie, I can see you're dying to ask her a million questions. She's got 180 questions, of which she's only asked three.
Terry, can you speak a little bit about how hard it was to come to South Africa in particular, at a time that was so complicated in terms of the beginnings of apartheid, the introduction of terrible persecution, and how that impacted on them, or somehow how it didn't impact. Mm. And I guess that's,
Well, I was curious, and I guess, you know, as the diaries slowly were, you know, as the diaries were unlocked, and it took a number of years, and the story of the translator is also an interesting story. The man that I found to translate the diaries, there's a very interesting story associated with him too. But in answer to your question, I kept looking for some sense. I kept wondering how it must have been to come from racism, ultimately genocide, to this country that was so, it was just implementing, it was 1948, and just beginning to implement what became a most terrible regime, and whether they identified in some way or felt compassion for the exact, you know, the sort of racist treatment of others, but they were very liberal, kind, generous, all of that. But I never found evidence in my grandfather's diaries. They escaped one incredibly racist order, one incredibly, you know, and had been racist all their lives, really. I mean, so many things, you know, there'd been pogroms in the cities they both grew up in from time to time. They really experienced racism themselves and then became complicit in another racist system, but didn't make the connection.
Did they ever talk about it? Or is this all the stuff that you've about come from the diaries?
Yeah, it comes from the diaries. I suppose I kept hoping my grandfather would make some connection between what they had experienced all their lives and what, you know, and the charmed lives that they were now leading at the expense of so many others.
It's quite sad, actually, because a lot of families don't have the history written down. They certainly don't have it written down. Some have been interviewed over the years. But, I mean, in the main, people who came from overseas, and I'm not talking about Holocaust survivors. Mm. I'm talking about people who just came to South Africa from Europe. They didn't really have somehow the will to hand over and talk about their childhood. I mean, my own grandparents and my own parents never really spoke of what took place there. And I mean, they all left in the 30s. My maternal grandmother left right at the beginning of the 20th century. But my parents and my grandparents came here in the 30s, 1930s. So they never talked about it. And it was only on the odd occasion did I have it. And it became more of a history lesson than a discussion about what they went through.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you had the notes and something to refer to, which is rare.
It is rare. It is rare. You started our conversation by asking me why I dwelt upon the Polish side of the family rather than the Lithuanian. And, you know, my mother was very attached to her Polish past. My father came here in 1928 as a 4-year-old. There was no sense in the Lithuanian family of any, there wasn't that same sense of loss. I mean, my Lithuanian grandmother, her protest, in spite of the fact that it saved her life, her husband insisting that they leave, saved her life, whereas all her siblings and parents, sure, and his siblings and parents landed up in a mass grave in the Ponar forest. Her sort of punishment of my grandfather on the Kurgan side and her resistance was never to learn to speak English properly. You know, she said, let them learn Yiddish. But my Lithuanian family there was not much interest or attachment to what came before. It was almost as if it had never happened. Whereas on the Polish side there, especially I suppose from my mother communicated both consciously and unconsciously. I inherited a great deal to do with what happened to them in Poland and before. There was a terrible sense of loss that permeated even meals, Friday night dinners. I mean, we didn't have roast chicken. We had duck or rabbit. That was Polish.
Yes, okay.
There's very interesting psychological research. There's a book called Survivor Cafe by Elizabeth Rosner, and she talks about how the different generations deal with the trauma, and she labels it 1G being first generation, 2G being second generation, which is you. And she talks about second generation being the artists, the writers, the psychologists, and that somehow first generation couldn't really engage with the trauma, having it almost too close or unable to articulate it, and somehow how 2G's work is to really give a language and in some ways begin a healing. And it seems like that's very much what your work is. It's so interesting how your last picture, you capture yourself in the image.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about its impact?
I mean, I think the book is an attempt at a retrieval of sorts. I mean, I can't articulate, you know, I mean, I've said this before when I've spoken about the book. I didn't personally suffer the loss that my grandparents or my mother did. I grew up white and charmed and in South Africa, but they lived with buried and repressed quite unspeakable acts, memories and loss. But I believe that these were delivered into my unconscious. It's that what I quoted earlier, the gaps left within us by the secrets of others. You know, they never spoke about these things. And going back, and particularly going back with my mother, was so interesting. But I think the photograph you're referring to right at the end of the book, I go and stay in all the hotels that they stayed in. I re-photograph in exactly the same spot that my grandfather took his original photograph of my grandmother, her lover, and my little mother whispering a secret into the lover's ear. I find that exact spot with the help of the owner of the hotel. The hotel hasn't changed. The external facade of the hotel hasn't changed. We go back to all those places and I suppose I was looking for, a molecule of air they might have breathed, you know, an eyelash, something left behind. And in the end, I'm photographing everything very carefully, making sort of panoramic sweeps around this grand dining room, which is exactly the same as the dining room that they ate at 75 years ago or 80 years ago. And suddenly when I come home and I'm looking through all these photographs, I hadn't noticed at the time, there I am in the mirror, you know, and it's sort of brought home, again, I don't want to spoil the way I end the book.
No, don't do that.
Yeah.
So we're coming to the end, and unfortunately, in photographic terms, this hour has gone by in a flash. So tell us a little bit about Terry Kurgan. What's Terry Kurgan all about? Tell us some of your work, some of what you do, how you started, where you are now.
Yeah. So I grew up in Cape Town, and my family emigrated when I graduated high school. I won't tell you how long ago. But I lived in the U.S. for 10 years where I studied undergraduate fine art. I came back to South Africa after 10 years of living in the U.S., and I, over a number of years, became a professional artist. And I work between writing and between multimedia projects. Currently, I'm working on another book, and this time it's to do with another family album, a much more morally ambiguous and complicated project. My father was a volunteer in 1948 in the Arab-Israeli War, and he was his own war photographer. So I'm looking at that album in relation to, I'm looking at the intersection of the Holocaust and the 1948 war, but again through a very personal lens. I also am a research associate at WISER, at WITS, which is where I'm working on this next project, and I'm doing a PhD I'm doing this book as a PhD in creative writing at the School of Creative Writing at WITS, where I also supervise and teach on the MA program. So I work between art, literature. I've got a very diverse body of work. I've been a professional artist for almost 30 years. And as I said a little earlier, depending upon the project, I choose the right medium to express whatever it is that I want to in a particular body of work. So while this ends up looking like a book, it's a real book, it's hardcover, it's linen covered, it's got lots of images and text, it feels as though it comes out of my art career. You know, it's just...
So if you want a copy of this book, and it's a book called Everyone is Present, it's Terry Kurgan, the author. We're talking to her in the studio, and we are asking you to say who is the independent South African publisher of this book. If you send in a telegram to 061-895-1019, or if you want to SMS to the number 34519, the independent South African publisher of the book Everyone is Present by Terry Kurgan. So let me tell you a little bit about the Hebrew Order of David. Hebrew Order of David is worldwide. We have lodges in America, Canada, England, Israel, and South Africa. And the Hebrew Order of David goes back to 1904. And one of the reasons, the main reason for its existence, was to look after immigrants coming to this country. And for many, many years, we were maybe their sole source of support. We gave them a meal. People came here with no families. Gave them meals, we gave them medical treatment, we gave them legal treatment, we found them jobs, et cetera, for right up until the 1950s when the new Medical Schemes Act came into, and we had to change now to become more of a philanthropic organization. But we're busy with a project which you may be interested in since you're an artist, and it's a day in the life of a Jew in South Africa, and we're looking for photographs. And you can enter this, there's a 25,000 rand prize or prizes, making up 25,000. You can send to photos@hodavid.org, or you can send WhatsApp to 082-963-4028. And we hope to bring out a coffee table book at some point. I think we would like to show what people are doing from a Jewish point of view. We've got Yon Tavian coming up now. And the pictures, we'll judge them. We'll load them onto our website and we will also hopefully publish this book in due course. There's no closing date at this stage, so you're welcome to send in. And maybe we're going to even ask Terry to come and be one of the judges. The other project which we're busy with at the moment is we have a project called Bringing Yont of Joy. Unfortunately, in the community, there are many families who need help, and especially at Yontif and Rosh Hashanah. So we add an extra pack in, which we have assistance with kosher mobile meals and delivering these parcels, and they're a little bit extra for Yontif at 180 Rand plus. We'd like you to add plus to that, and you send it into our bank account or into the credit card system, which we use is PayFast. And if you want to contact the office of the HRD to make a donation, 011-640-3017, or it's info@hrdavid.org. So we've gone through the evening. We haven't chosen a winner of the wheel, announce a winner at the end, because there's about 300 people have written in and the inundated by calls on this. And so if you want to try and get a copy of this book, we're going to put one of the books in that library at the HRD, which we're busy with now, the archives, and it should be open for business in 2020. And you can send a telegram to 061-895-1019 or SMS 34519. The question is, who is the independent South African publisher who published Terry Kurgan's book, Everyone is Present? Terry, a final word on what are you doing besides this book that you're bringing out? What's the future for Terry? I mean, you're still a young lady. You've got plenty of go in you. And I see the books that you've written. One of them is Hotel Piccadilly. I'm not Hotel. Yeovil. And I have actually a connection to Yeovil because I did a lot of property transactions in the Yeovil area. So I know it well. And it's interesting to know. And also, the Hebrew Order of David is the home of the Jewish Genealogical Society of South Africa. And I'm sure they'd be fascinated to have you come and talk to a group there. We have a monthly meeting. And, I'm sure you've got a tale to tell and, the book to sell. Sorry about the rhyme. Natalie, you're down to about 160 something questions left. I'm sure you're dying to ask one last question. No?
Well, you asked me what I was working on.
Yes.
Aside from the new book. My grandfather's diaries, the ones that I have in possession, have been fully translated between 1939 and 1973, and the book only covers between 1935 and 1945. And I have extraordinary material for other projects. I'm trying to work on a film project in relation to some of, for example, my grandfather recorded his dreams. He recorded the books that he noted what he was reading. He wrote recipes. So I've got all these folders and subfolders of content that I'm using in different ways for other projects. I have a lifetime of projects that can be drawn out of these extraordinary diaries, and I'm eternally grateful to him. I just wish that he could read the book.
Yes, sounds like an amazing person. I mean, it's hard life, but he's all his work is bearing fruit, and it's coming through you.
Yeah.
And kola kavod, yeshakayach.
Thank you.
On a fantastic effort and for the work that you do. And a lot of it is in the South African context. A lot of your work, your photographs and all that sort of thing is really about society in South Africa.
Yeah, so most of my work is quite socially engaged with here. This was the first time I did such a personal project. Yeah.
And at the end of it, how did you feel? You feel satisfied? Or is it, as you said in the big, as your critic, Andrew van Vlies says, you're, what did he say? The most accomplished and sophisticated theorist of her own photographic practice.
You should have quoted some of the other things he said in that review.
That was the only one I didn't understand. I understood all the others.
Yeah. No, I feel very, it's been very affirming how well the book's been taken up. You know, the fact that it's been shortlisted for the Patent Prize and the emails and the phone calls and the text messages. People really, I didn't know this because I've never written this kind of book, but people come back to me me and they tell me how they felt about it. They tell me their stories. The feedback has been very affirming and I feel immensely grateful. And also it's sort of put something back together for me working on a project like this.
So what amazes me, and I get amazed every day because a lot of people come to us bringing stuff and there's memorabilia and I went to the Holocaust Museum the other day and I'm listening to you and it just seems that everybody has a story.
Yes.
It's just waiting to be told. And you took something and you made it come alive and that in itself is an accomplishment. And it's been a privilege and a real pleasure having you in the studio. You managed to tolerate Natalie's questions.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, really. Thank you both.
Yes, and thanks to DJ Flo, patiently at the controls, and thanks to Natalie Solomon for setting up the interview, and thanks, Terry, for the books and for your insight and for really a callback of the past. I mean, an amazing story.
Thank you.
Thank you. And good night and good Shabbos to everyone.